Welcome to Embrace Your Brain's exciting new series called Embracing the Mature Mind. Join Dr. Dee Coulter as she explores the natural brilliance awaiting us all in the upper decades.
Welcome to the podcast. Today's topic, unlearning helplessness. You know, we didn't even have the term learned helplessness until the mid-1970s, but it caught on really fast, and over the next 10 years, we used it a lot. For a while there, we thought we had all the answers about how to motivate kids and adults who'd given up on situations, or worse yet, given up on themselves. Some of those ideas are still useful today, and neuroscience has given us a deeper understanding of the problem that can take us even further in our quest to help folks unlearn helplessness. Today, we're going to mine the gems from that earlier era. And in the next podcast, we'll drill down into the conditions we just couldn't fix back then. At the core, giving up was seen as a problem of how we thought. We had learned to give up, so the strategies relied on working with unlearning that idea by changing what we were saying to ourselves. And we created strategies for doing just that. We concluded that once a person had learned that some situation was hopeless, they began to rehearse storylines about how impossible it was, and those thoughts were embedding the pattern to the point where they gave up on similar situations really quickly. So here's what we identified as the drivers behind it all. It boiled down to two patterns. One was a deep need to control a situation that they dreaded, and a failure to do so. That lack of control led to what we call depressed learned helplessness. The other was a deep need to be able to predict when a dreaded situation would happen again, and a failure to do that. That lack of predictability led to anxious learned helplessness. So here's what it looked like with the kids I used to teach in my special ed classes back then. I saw anxious learned helplessness most clearly with math. When I tried to show them how to solve a kind of problem, of course it was going to be confusing at first, but if they would just keep at it, soon they'd see a pattern. But they got frustrated too fast, and they gave up. Their tolerance for ambiguity, for confusion, for uncertainty, whatever we want to call it, was so low that they couldn't put up with it. Over time, this low frustration tolerance turned into anxiety and began to look like distractibility. We see that now as attention deficit disorder, but really, they have an attention overload disorder. The confusion of new learning is making them so anxious that they just can't focus. Good students don't have that problem. They grow to enjoy the sense of ambiguity because they know that soon they're going to be getting the great aha feeling that comes with discovering patterns. The other problem pattern I saw was easy to see with the kids who struggled with reading. With out loud reading, they could stumble along and get a vague sense of phonics and guess at the words. But once they were asked to do silent reading, they were lost. Their inner speech didn't kick in. When they looked at the page, no sound happened in their heads. So these kids often felt they had no control over reading at all, and soon the very sight of a book would shut them down. Many even went a step further and decided it wasn't just reading, it was their brain. They were too stupid to learn, and they began to hate school. If we were able to help them learn to hear their inner speech, they often recovered nicely. For those with serious dyslexia, we didn't have much to offer back then, but today we have all sorts of workarounds for them too. So here's the question. Are you seeing the tendency to get overly anxious or depressed with situations in life, either in yourself or the adults and children around you? Let's look at the strategies that were so helpful back then, and they're still great tools for today. They all have to do with addressing that inner speech. What are we saying to ourselves, and how do we explain our failures? The simplest one was called affirmations. That's still quite popular today. Whenever we hear ourselves doing some negative self-talk, we can interrupt it by saying something positive like, I can do this. The situation is perfectly simple. I'm a capable person, whatever. If we say it often enough, we can sometimes turn those thoughts around. We can unlearn the idea that we're going to fail. We had a more advanced strategy, too, and we called it attribution retraining. Basically, it involved challenging the person's explanation about why they failed. If they saw it as outside of their control, we called it external fate control. Here's how it worked. If a situation turned out well, they'd just say it was good luck. Or maybe the task was so easy anyone could do it. And if the situation turned out badly and they failed, they blamed it on bad luck. Or said the task was simply too hard. Our goal was to challenge that and give them different ways to talk about it, based on their own capacities. We'd call that internal fate control. So we'd encourage them to see the task as something they could do if they just tried harder, or something we could show them how to do. In both cases, they could learn to succeed with effort. But some situations are harder to fix. They're more sudden or more disruptive, so then what? Back then, we were fascinated with what we called the survivor personality. Even when faced with situations that they couldn't control or even see coming, somehow these survivors still coped. They seemed to draw on a core resiliency. When an intense negative event happened, it would stop them in their tracks, just like it would anyone, but after a few days of shock, they'd bounce back. Here's a powerful example. Recently, Texas experienced a million-acre fire. It devastated cattle ranchers, their herds, and their land. On the news, they interviewed one cattle rancher who had been particularly hard hit. He said he had lost 200 cattle. Only 25 or so were left. It had taken 10 years to build up that herd, and he wasn't sure he had enough time in his life to build it back up again so his son could carry on. He was clearly grieving the loss of those precious cattle and of that wonderful grazing land. But when he was asked what he was going to do next, he said he was heading out to round up his remaining cattle and see that they were fed, and then he would look for some land to graze them on. He demonstrated a deep understanding that, yeah, bad things can happen, but you can move through it and respond. You don't have to simply give up. There's one more state of learned helplessness, and that's apathy. It's the hardest state to treat. And it's showing up much more frequently these days. Many middle and high school kids, post-COVID, aren't motivated. New employees are quitting jobs as soon as they face challenges or get bored. And many voters are so apathetic that they may not even bother to vote. We'll take a close look at this serious and increasing problem of apathy and how to address it in our next podcast. I really hope you'll join me in this important conversation. Please send your comments for sharing to d@embraceyourbrain.com. I look forward to hearing from you.